Devin, welcome members. We have two bills to hear today, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on both bills, a public hearing on House Bill 2214 and a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 54. Representative Cannon is here, and he has another committee he needs to attend, so we will offer him the courtesy of coming forth after Mr. Olson describes the bill to give us his thoughts on his proposal. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Joint Resolution 54 proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution requiring the Legislative Assembly to appropriate biannually a minimum sum for the state system of public education. It specifies bases for amounts required for kindergarten through grade 12 system, community college system, and the higher education system. Provides for a phase-in of constitutional requirement. Authorizes the Legislative Assembly to appropriate amount that is less than the amount constitutionally required if approved by 3/5 of the members in each House. The measure refers the proposed amendment to the people for their approval or rejection at the next regular general election. As no subsequent referral. Would you like me to speak to the other bill, or should we do it after Representative Cannon?
We want to do it after Representative Cannon.
Okay.
That would be fine. Representative Cannon, welcome. Good to see you. And please let us know your thoughts, Flying House Joint Resolution 54.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ben Cannon, House District 46 in parts of southeast and northeast Portland. I appreciate the chair and the committee hearing this bill, as well as the other bill that you've opened the public hearing on. Both represent attempts to think over the long term about education funding in this state. Both, if passed, would move the state towards excellence, not mere adequacy in education funding, and I certainly want to express my appreciation to the governor and his staff who've worked closely with me to explain the other bill that you'll be hearing today, and I am fully supportive of that concept. The resolution that I bring forward stems from my campaign and the kinds of conversations I had with voters over the course of a year as I was on doorsteps. The number one issue, the single most important issue to voters in my district, and I think to voters around the state, is education. And in particular, as they look at the state legislature, it's education funding. And citizens of Oregon, I believe, are tired of sort of piecemeal approaches to education funding. They're tired of roller coaster budgets. They're tired of budgets that even in good years, like good bienniums, like the one arguably that we are entering, fail to restore the full extent of the cuts that we've made since passage of Measure 5 in the early 90s. So I took that, you know, when I got to Salem, I said, what did I hear about what on doorsteps for a year the most, and what can I offer? And I developed this resolution from that standpoint. The question I asked, what do Oregonians want? And the answer, I believe, is a pathway towards a world-class education system that will be the engine for the development of Oregon's economic and human potential. I think our state faces really two choices, and we're at a critical point right now. We can have a future that's based on creativity and inventiveness of our citizens, or one that increasingly depends for its economy on often repetitive service jobs. I think that is the stark choice we face. We can become a bedroom community to the innovation that's happening in California and Washington, or we can join that club as a place that really is the center for world-class research, development, economic growth, business entrepreneurship. So this resolution reverses the usual paradigm for thinking about education funding. Usually, we ask as a legislature, all right, what can we spend on education? We all agree it's important. What can we spend? This shifts the conversation, not how much money do we have to spend, what can we afford for education, but to instead the notion of if we build this system, this world-class system, the jobs, businesses, culture, human development will occur. And so it says, let's turn this on its head. What should we spend? And then let's let the legislature and the people of Oregon figure out how to get there. So what I propose in HJR 54 is a way of funding that looks at education, kindergarten through higher ed. It shares with the proposal of the other bill that you'll hear today that belief that we should be looking at the full education continuum, kindergarten through higher ed. It turns the notion of shared responsibility into a proposal of what is the state's responsibility for education? What percentage of educational costs should the state bear? So it answers that question by moving us and our K-12 funding towards 100% of QEM over a series of five biennium. It says that for our higher education system, the state should bear something closer to the national average of 70% of the cost of educating our students in higher ed. And for community college and workforce development programs, it says that we should be at 50% of the cost per student of that good work that goes on there. This is a philosophy of investment founded on the belief that education will grow the economy. We can't simply wait for the reverse to be true. We can't continue to wait for the revenue to come in order to build the system that we want. We have to step forward as a legislature and say, this is the system that Oregonians want and need, and the economy will follow. This is a constitutional amendment, as you see. It requires ratification by the voters of Oregon. This is so that voters will have a real say on something that would represent a significant change in the way that we develop our education budgets. And the legislature, of course, would be bound to the results, which statute alone cannot do. So the legislature would be bound to follow the requirements of HJR 54, although we have included an opt-out clause, a three-fifths vote, and you can imagine plenty of scenarios under which perhaps a state emergency or some other really immediate crisis would require us not to meet the funding standards proposed in this resolution, and with a three-fifths vote of, I believe, both chambers, the legislature could choose not to fund education at these levels. I'll point out just a couple of additional things before responding to any questions. One is that you may be interested to know where we are currently. And if I'm correct in using the proposed figures in the co-chair's budget, the upcoming 07-09 appropriation, once you include the local funds for K-12, would be at a little over 80%, maybe 84% of the what the quality education model represents at community college and workforce development. And I'm sure there are people behind me who will correct me if I'm wrong on any of these. At the community college level, we're looking at about 40% of the full student cost, and we've had quite a few conversations with folks in community college to try to get a handle on that. But we were at one time in this state at 50%. We're now going to be at 40%. And OUS, the university system, will be at roughly 61% of the student cost rather than the 70%. So this sets targets that are somewhat higher than where we're at now. I would argue that historically they're not far off our high water mark. And they are consistent with the place that the governor's bill that you'll also hear today gets us over time. So these represent two different mechanisms for getting basically to the same place. Given our current revenue projections as we look over five biennia, this would not require an increasing share of the general fund. It would not, in other words, it would not require making cuts to public safety, human services, and other state activities. It would merely continue to keep us at our, you know, roughly 60% education and its roughly 60% share of general fund. That does, of course, assume that revenue grows the way it's been modeled to grow by our revenue officer here in the Capitol. So that's my presentation. I'd be, of course, happy to entertain questions. I really appreciate it. I think this is really important for us to begin this conversation. I shouldn't say it's the beginning. People have been talking about stable, adequate funding for education in this state for a long time. But I think it's incumbent on us to continue to look not just at the 07-09 appropriation. We're going to have a lot of conversations about that in this building over the next couple of months, but also about the long term and how we really move Oregon's education system to world-class status.
Thank you very much, Representative. Are there any questions, Representative Cannon? Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cannon, this is, as you know, a friendly question since my name's on the bill as well and I support it. I've been asked to check with legislative counsel on the bill I'm supporting, HGR 18, which would put the right to health care in the Constitution. And the question that I've been asked to ask of LC is, what if the legislature doesn't do it? And what if they don't vote it out by three-fifths? What if they just don't do it? And they produce a budget that doesn't meet this. What then?
Thank you, Representative.
As a friend of mine.
Yeah.
Well, it is. I'm trying to get that answer for mine, too. I'll share it.
I would assume.
It's an important question.
It is an important question. I think the legislature has other obligations under the Constitution, and I would sort of defer to our legal counsel about what the consequences are if the legislature, for instance, does not produce a balanced budget for the biennium, which I believe is a constitutional obligation that we have. It would create presumably some kind of constitutional crisis, and I can't speak to that as an attorney, but it certainly, I think, in practice, what this would represent is a very strong statement by the people of Oregon that it expects our legislature to meet these targets or else with a supermajority decide not to.
Representative Roman.
Thank you.
I'll be glad to share my letter when I get it.
a while back, some of my school board members from one of my districts came and asked me that if I was going to be offended if I was cited to be sued by them with a lawsuit going to against the state for not upholding, you know, ballot measure one, Scottsdale Shield. And I said, you know, you need to do what you need to do, and that's fine. I'll be fine with that. And they apparently did join in that action. Which is now proceeding, and I see this kind of as an affront to that because it's not letting the courts answer the question that they've been wanting to have asked. And if we intercede and do this ahead of time, I think that, from my perspective, is not serving them taking the actions they've already invested money in and trying to find an answer for. So from my perspective, how do you see this affecting that ongoing action that's being taken?
Chair Buckley, Representative Roblin, I am not... I can't speak with any authority to where in the legal process that particular litigation is. I know that it is still pending. It's not my intention to interfere with that case. I think that respecting those plaintiffs and their desire to see it through is certainly sensible. And I would only point out that this would not take effect until, I believe, the biennium that begins in 2011. So, in my view, that is ample time to allow the existing ballot measure one language, which this amends, the opportunity to get sort of seen through by the courts.
Follow up.
I am one of those people who really hopes that our judicial system is not a political system. You know, it's the judges doing their own thing. But if they see this as being done, I could easily see them saying, well, we really don't need to deal with this issue because it's already taken care of in 2011. So all of a sudden, the issue is moot. That's a concern I have.
Right. And my response, I mean, Representative Robin and Chair Buckley, and we could have certainly a longer conversation about this. I would be very interested to know whether the plaintiffs in that sort of lawsuit would see the passage of this as inadequate education funding. I mean, this goes back to a high water mark in Oregon funding and really goes beyond that. And so I think that this resolution and this approach is one that the plaintiffs, those who want, like most Oregonians, I believe, full and adequate funding of education in the state, would be actually quite excited about.
One follow-up, and I apologize because
that's fine.
I didn't ask my district if they were offended. Have you tasked any of the people who are in that group?
I have, Representative Roblin and Chair Buckley, and I know they do have some concern about the issue that you have raised.
Okay. Thank you.
So the individual members were severed from that lawsuit.
I know. I kind of understood that and explained that to them. So.
We keep our hands out of our pockets.
Now that the two signatories to the bill have asked you easy questions, I'll ask you a hard one. This concept, Representative Cannon, is not foreign to me. In fact, I support your efforts. But my question is, we're looking into a biennium which is healing us up from three legislative sessions. As you move backwards in time, each one more painful than the one we come forward to. What happens when our economy cycles and we get into a downturn? We're enjoying a 20% increase in revenue this time. What happens when we see a 20% reduction in revenue to the schools?
Representative Dallum and Chair Buckley, that's a very good and very important question. One of two things happens. Either the legislature does, with three-fifths margins in both houses, choose to go beneath these thresholds, or it adopts revenue reforms that extend, you know, the obligation of Oregonians to fund a system even in a time of economic downturn. I hope that if this passes, legislators will do the courageous thing, which is look into the future, as I think we've begun to do this session, anticipate that kind of potential, and study and adopt changes to our revenue system that will allow the legislature to meet its obligations under HJR 54, even in the case of a 20% economic recession like we suffered in beginning in 2001. So I think I see this as really helping advance that conversation about a more stable and more adequate revenue system in the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Representative King.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions, but I want to clarify something first. So what this is doing is that there's going to be this commission, which right now is a QEM commissioner, or QEC, and they identify the QEM, and they say, because that's what's established by law, and they say it costs $9 billion to educate a kid in the state of Oregon. So we're then obligated in K-12 to fund K-12 education at $9 billion. And I'm using that as a supposition, right?
Yes, that's correct. Over a 10-year, it would have a 10-year phase-in period that would move us to that 100% over those five biennia, yes.
And if they say that it costs $4 billion to run the state higher ed system, then we're obligated to fund higher ed at $2 billion.
Actually be higher than that. For higher ed, it's 70%, so
70%.
More like
community
college under $3 billion. Sorry, community college would be half. 50%.
Okay, and then higher ed. So let's see, if I say $10 billion, then it's $7 billion. I can do the math. Okay, I just wanted to clarify that. So my question is first of all, is this going to withstand the Armada decision from 1998?
I can't answer that, Representative Carmel, Chair Buckley. I can't give you an answer to that question.
Okay.
I don't know.
Are you proposing this then as a... I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Follow-up. Okay.
Are you proposing this as a legislative amendment as a constitutional amendment or as a constitutional revision? Constitutional revision.
Representative Crummell, Chair Buckley, this would... In asking LC to draft this, I believe that I asked for a constitutional amendment. That may not... I recognize that where you're going with these questions. That may not withstand the single subject test. And in which case it would be a revision.
It's a referral.
Well, either way, it's going to be a referral. But right. A revision requires 40 votes in the House and 20 votes in the and 20 votes in the Senate. An amendment only requires a simple majority in the House and a simple majority in the Senate. But you have the issue of the single subject ruling under Armada. If this can't withstand Armada, then an amendment is probably not going to be the way to go. I'm just curious as to what you're thinking.
We take a second to declare. Did you have something else, Ms. Olson?
Just one clarifying note. In paragraph 1 of House Joint Resolution 54, it does say the Constitution of the State of Oregon is amended by creating a new Section 9 to be added and made a part of Article 8, and by amending Section 8, Article 8, such sections to read, and then it goes on. So it both amends an existing section and adds a new section, is my understanding. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I would just note that Representative Cannon, I'm sure, joins many people in Oregon who would not be able to at this point say exactly where Armada falls on an issue like this.
Well, but I'm just curious as to whether or not that's something that had been talked about or discussed between you and LC. My other question is, what security do we have that the school districts are going to spend the money in such a way? I mean, it's easy for somebody independent, for this commission, for example, to say, you know, it costs $8 billion or $9 billion or $28 billion, and then they leave it to us to come up with the money. There's also a little bit of the issue of whether or not people feel like they're getting the value add, if you will, and what their return on investment is. So I guess, you know, the question becomes, what security do we have in this? Because basically right now the school districts can go out and negotiate whatever they want to. They negotiate with the teachers' unions, and they negotiate with their administrators and their janitors' unions and everybody else, and then they come and hand us the bill. And we have no say whatsoever in what they negotiate. So my question is, how do we ensure then through this process that when we say we're going to fund it, we're obligated to fund it at 100%, we're not getting a hell of a lot of say in terms of what that 100% is.
I'll answer that in two ways, Representative Carmel, Chair Buckley. One is that voters will continue to have the power to elect or not elect their local school boards who enter into through their school districts, enter into those contracts and other decisions that are made at the local level. And the second is, of course, that voters would have the opportunity to look at the way we're currently spending our education dollars and decide whether or not this kind of investment makes sense given the current model. I think that's the value here in having a statewide referendum on this kind of concept rather than simply sort of applying it at the legislative level.
President Lin.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill. This is a very admirable ideas in it, but my question is, do you know any other state has a similar legislation currently working at this time we can model after?
Representative Lin, Chair Buckley, that's a very good question. I do not know of a state that has something like this that uses percentage of full student cost as a sort of constitutional requirement. I do know that states, including, well, Florida has used class size. I think it's in their constitution or at least in statute in a very prominent way to require its school districts to essentially spend a lot more money on education. That was voter approved. This, I think, is a more practical and appropriate way of getting to a similar place, which is excellence in education. But it's a good question and one that I will do more research on to confirm whether or not it's the case that Oregon would be the only state to embark way.
The first. Thank you, Kameen. Representative Kim, thank you so much for bringing this forward. Thank you for your time with us today. And we will drag you back for further conversations, I'm sure.
I appreciate that, Chair, and I'm sorry that I can't stay for any of the additional discussion, but thank you very much for hearing the bill.
Thank you for being here. Kameen, before we move on, Mr. Olson is going to read a summary of House Bill 5014. I did want to take a minute, reminded by Mr. Olson, that just to, on behalf of the Education Committee, express our solidarity and our mourning with the Virginia Tech community after the events of this week. So on behalf of the House Education Committee, I would like to offer those thoughts. Mr. Sager, would you please come forward, and Mr. Olson, would you be so kind?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2214 directs the Legislative Assembly to appropriate public education programs, funds, and agencies amount that is not less than 61% of projected revenues in the general fund beginning with the 2007-2009 biennium. It requires that subsequent biennial appropriations for each program, fund, or agency be not less than 110% of amount appropriated for prior biennium, limits the amount of monies that may be appropriated to the state school fund, directs the Legislative Assembly to distribute amount above 10% growth to the Education, Opportunity, and Innovation Fund and the Education Stability Fund, establishes the Education, Opportunity, and Innovation Fund, establishes the pre-kindergarten through grade 12 successful schools account within the Education, Opportunity, and Innovation Fund, continuously appropriates monies in the account to the Department of Education for grants to school districts, establishes the post-secondary academic and workforce investment account within the Education, Opportunity, and Innovation Fund, continuously appropriates monies in the account for distribution for higher education purposes, directs the Joint Boards of Education to adopt rules for grants awarded from the accounts, and directs the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to prepare computations and estimates of revenue received and projected revenue, declares an emergency, becomes effective July 1st, 2007. We have before you a -2 amendment, which replaces the entire text of House Bill 2214 and makes the following main changes. One, it adds the floor to the state school fund no less than 80% of the amount of money is determined to be sufficient for that biennium by the Quality Education Commission, unquote. Deletes a baseline of $5.36 million for the state school fund appropriation. Also changes the name of the pre-kindergarten through grade 12 successful schools account to the, quote, school improvement account. And it clarifies the formula for K-12 and post-secondary funds distributions, as well as clarifies language on the distribution of funds from the school improvement account. It currently has a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Commission, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Sager, welcome back, and I look forward to hearing you talk us through House Bill 2214.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. For the record, James Sager from the Governor's Office, and I'm going to apologize right up front. The teacher in me says don't hand out these two spreadsheets I have until I'm ready to talk about them. So in a moment, after I walk through the bill, after I walk through the bill, I'll pass those around, and then I'll walk you through those two spreadsheets. So if you you don't mind, I will quickly walk you through the -2 amendments and view it just as a standpoint, from the standpoint that it is the bill. Section 1, we list the definitions of what we mean by the education enterprise, clarifying that it is pre-K through 20. It includes the Oregon Health Science University and the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. It is the enterprise, as the governor has talked about it. On in Section 2, it establishes what we believe is the process that is necessary to move this state not only towards stable but also adequate funding for the entire continuum, and that is that it establishes that 61% of the general fund revenues at a minimum would be allocated to the enterprise, and that each sector, so K-12, community college, university, OSAC, others would receive at least a 10% increase each biennium. The as you move to the bottom of page 2 is where we inserted the second floor, and that was inserted quite honestly at the request of the speaker, because that has been an issue that he has.
Are we talking about an amendment or the bill itself?
We're talking about the amendment, Representative Greenick.
The dash two amendment.
I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear. So on the bottom of page 2 is where we inserted the fact that for K-12, it is the floor increase is either 10% or 80% of the quality education model, whichever is greater. When we you move ahead to page 3, we talk then about what would happen with the revenues that are above the 10%, but you still haven't reached 61% of the general fund revenue that's been allocated. And what this indicates is that those dollars then go to the Education Opportunity and Innovation Fund, and it's those funds that will be distributed out across the sectors, and I'll explain that distribution in just a few moments. We then move to at the bottom of page 3 and the top page 4 for both the governor and the legislature. If there is a significant restriction or change in state revenues, the governor or the legislature can, in essence, ignore this requirement. In talking with the governor, the way he viewed this quite clearly was that we periodically have, by voter initiative, unfunded directives to the legislature that, you know, causes us pause to look at how we're going to deal with it. So if, in fact, that were to occur and it were to have a significant impact on the legislature's ability to budget money, that there should be some ability for the legislature to take that into consideration, as well as the governor. And so that's why that language was put in there bottom page three and top page four. The section three makes it clear that this begins with the biennia starting after July 1, 2009, so it is really putting in place the process that we would use then in developing the next budget. And just for the record, it is, in fact, the process we tried to use in developing this budget for the governor. So as we thought about creating the state budget. The section four is a process that will take place beginning in 2011. And let me explain the difference. Up until July 1 of 2011, all of the additional funds above the 10% minimum will go into the innovation account. Those dollars are then distributed proportionately to the sectors through a process. Starting July 1, 2011, two-thirds of that excess could go into the Education Stability Fund if it is needed to help restore that account. All the projections indicate that the lottery funds that currently go into that account will, in fact, fill it to its 5% cap limitation during the next biennia. So nothing from the general fund will be needed. But the governor wanted to make sure that in future biennia that we have the ability to put additional money into that stability fund if we need it. And so that mechanism then would be in place. And the way that would occur then is the amount determined to be in excess, two-thirds of that excess would go into the stability fund as long as there's still room under the cap. One-third goes into the innovation account for distribution. Again, you reach the cap, all the money goes into the innovation account. And you kind of follow that through page 6. The top of page 7, section 5, is where it states that that portion that I just explained to you doesn't become effective until July 1, 2011. So I'm kind of out of sequence here, but I'm trying to follow the bill. Section 6 talks about how the Education Opportunity Innovation Fund will be distributed, so the amount above the 10% minimum. And we have two different accounts. One is the school improvement account that's already in statute. So 77% of the innovation money will go into the school improvement account for K-12. 23% will go into a new account called the Post-Secondary Academic and Workforce Investment Account. And those dollars will be distributed then according to the formula under Section 7, where we break out the allocation to the higher ed, the university system, to the community college system, to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, monies to the Oregon Health Sciences University proportionally distributed to those. In Section 8, then we clarify that distribution and the coordination of those dollars will be carried out by the joint boards of education working with these sectors. And if I could deviate from just explaining the bill, let me maybe explain that a little bit. We could just put all the money into a lump account and say it's there. It became clear to the governor that in order to understand what the impact could be on the system and how you invest strategically throughout the system, you needed to allocate some funds to those and then say, now boards of education, work at telling us how you're going to align this work. It also then would allow the joint boards to come forward with recommendations that if in fact part of an allocation, and I'll pick on the shared responsibility model of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission for the benefit of Representative Plem, if it was determined that the amount allocated to that fund was going to be more than what the pickup rate of student use is going to be, then in fact the joint boards could recommend that some of those dollars be redistributed to community colleges, universities. But again, it stays inside that area of interest in the budget. So I just wanted to kind of add some clarity for you for that. But this section, Section 8, allows the joint boards then to create those rules that will set up that process. And in subsection 4 makes it clear that, in fact, reports will come back to the legislature as to what decisions, what rules were made, and why the decisions were made to recommend the investments that do come forward then in the budget proposals. When you move to, and section 9 talks about the school improvement account. Section 10 is actually beginning of clarifying language for the benefit of the treasurer's office. They had, we were using inappropriate words like the word fund, and they use accounts, and so we had to bring the language in line with the way the treasurer's office allocates money. In subsection 3, once again, it clarifies that for the K-12 portion of the funding, that not only do we have a minimum, a floor set for the system, but in fact there's a ceiling, and that ceiling is 100% of the quality education model, so that we understand the parameters. And then, again, then we move through section 11, and that's where it determines the language about projecting what these revenues are and what the treasurer's office has to do, et cetera. So I hope I don't have to go into much detail for you on that. And if you don't mind, Chair Buckley, I will pass out these forms and I'll walk you through them.
We've been very attentive. I think we deserve those forms.
I wish some of my former classes were this attentive. So two different forms are coming around. I'm sorry, I should have collated them. Let me explain to you what you'll be seeing here in a moment. what we have done is ask the question, so what does this mean to education? We have two indicators that have been developed. One is the quality education model as it relates to K-12. The other indicator was a question that was actually presented or requested by Representative Cannon to the university system. And the question was that historically, about 70% of the cost of the university system was provided by the state and 30% was provided through tuition. That has totally flipped. 30% is by the state, 70% is by tuition. What would it take over a period of time to move us back in greater balance to that original position that we were in? So if you look at the document that at the top is called Illustration Draft, what we have done is taken each sector of the enterprise. So the first one is the OUS system. And we have put in under that column, assuming that the co-chair's number for the K-12 funding at 6245 is what leaves this building, and assuming that we at least restore for the post-secondary system the governor's recommended budget, what does that mean over the next several years to the education system? And so if you look at the university system at the top, you'll see that we talk about what does the 10% minimum do, what would their proportion of the innovation fund distribution mean, and what their total general fund support would be for each biennia. If you move to the far right-hand side, you'll see the number $1.249 billion. Ironically, that number represents about 91% of the effort to get back to the 70-30 split. So in other words, it clearly puts us on the trajectory, once again, of putting the state in a position where we're saying we're providing, the state is providing the support needed for the post-secondary system. We don't have, or I didn't have an analysis for the community colleges, but in talking with the commissioner earlier today, the feeling was because of the way we've kind of lined up the proportions of the distribution. In fact, we felt we were probably within about 90% of their target also by that time. So it clearly puts us on a path of restoring that kind of adequate funding for the sectors. If you move down to the K-12 number, then I'd like to refer you to the second piece of paper where we actually have the ability to break things down even finer for you and compare them against the quality ed model and other indicators. So on this form, if you'll look on the column that's titled 0709, you'll see the kind of dark, the shaded area. The 5985 and the 260, those two together represent the co-chair's budget of 6245. You add in the local revenues, and we have created a number of comparisons or measurements down below. That is, if we look at both state and local revenues as a percent of the quality education model, under this formula, we would be at 86% for this biennia, and we would move to 97% by the 13-15 biennia as you move across. We also broke that down because oftentimes when we talk about percentage of the quality ed model, we only talk about the state's share of that allocation. So I've also provided you that comparison that at 6245, we're at 81% of the state's share. And again, that moves to 97%, and both the local revenue and the state revenue comes in line to match up with 97% of the quality ed model. So for the first time ever, we have in front of us a plan that says here is how strategically, based on current revenue forecasts, we can move this state towards the goal that has been stated, which is 100% of the quality education model. It also ironically moves us towards the goal of restoring our investment in our post-secondary system and provides support throughout the system. And so the governor is very committed to this idea, believes that this is the kind of statement and priority that as a state we need to make clear, and we hope that you will agree to allow this bill to move forward and we can be successful.
Thank you, Mr. Saker. Excellent work, and I appreciate your detailed running through of this for us.
Any questions to start? I thought Representative Crummell might have a question. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question in the amendments, and I, you know, just like everyone else, just sort of been trying to fly through them, but on page two of the amendments, section two, it talks about, you know, except as provided, yada yada yada, the biennium begins July 1 of each year, that the legislative assembly will put in 61% or 110%. One of the arguments that I hear a lot of times when there's something like this that requires some kind of strategic planning into the future is that, well, this is tying the hands of future legislatures, and, you know, we can't do that. We can't tie the hands of future legislatures. So what about that?
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, that's a very good question, and that's why this is presented from the governor to you as statutory language. Technically, the legislature can act notwithstanding and ignore statutory language. On the other hand, the governor feels very strongly that both as governor and the legislative assembly needs to be very clear that education is a priority, that while we have created things like the quality ed model and we have set standards in for the state, we need to put in place a plan to fund what is needed, and we need to do it over a period of time where the system can ramp up and adequately use the number. So while technically, because it is not constitutional, you can ignore it, it's the governor's belief that, in fact, we will all be motivated to try and carry it out.
Okay. Thank you. Additional questions? Representative Wisner.
First for you, Mr. Chair. Who else are we having testify?
We have a number of people that would like to testify on this bill, Representative. We have folks in the community colleges, folks from higher ed, the Oregon Student Association, the OEA, OSEA, the OPTA, Stanford Children.
Thank you. I have two quick questions, I hope.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Steger, for your presentation. I've been a supporter of the enterprise system, but always it's the details of the proposal. Did the governor or the staff consider a referral to the people if we want to make this permanent, like Representative Cannon?
Chair Buckley, Representative Wisnett, the governor, being a former Supreme Court justice, has a real passion about the Oregon Constitution and feels that, you know, certain things should be in there and other things should be in statute and dealt with as such. And so that's why his belief is this is the best way to do it, and that, in fact, the external pressures that always exist against the governor and the legislature will help us meet the requirements of the statute.
Follow up.
Follow.
And I'll resist my temptation to get into too much of the numbers
Sure. That
you know I have. But I think I have to ask you about the second page of your handout, the footnote in 3, how you picked up the education sector price increases.
Yeah.
And how you went from 82 to 86 to 7.7 to, or excuse me, not 82, 8.2, 8.6, 7.7, and 7.6. I have to ask about that one.
Chair Buckley, Representative Wisnett, working very closely with the Department of Education, Brian Reeder is the person who looks at all of the various factors that impact education. So it's not simply looking at Portland CPI, for instance. It is looking at all those indicators. These are the same indicators that the Revenue Forecast Committee uses in order to prepare the EBL number 4 K-12 that's presented to the legislature. So it is a calculation that is agreed to by the department, by LFO, BAM, and others. So that's why we looked at that as the positive indicator to try and project future costs and thus needs.
Okay. Just one final follow-up. And I apologize, I haven't gone through all the amendments that detail, but in the staff summary sheet, it says we're deleting the baseline of 5.36 million. Could you comment on that, please?
Yes, Chair Buckley, Representative Wisnett. At the time that we were writing this bill, the governor had determined, had stated several times that 5.318 was the baseline, regardless of whatever the LAB was out of the last session. Since the time we started writing and we're in this part of the session, that number really became irrelevant to have it in the bill. So that's why we simply removed it, because the baseline numbers have adjusted to the point where the way that this bill approaches it is we're looking at this current biennia, the efforts that I think we all collectively hope are the exit point for this session, become the baseline, and we apply those then to future biennia.
So clarification, Mr. Chair. So then 6.245 is the baseline, is that what you're saying? Not 6.3?
Chair Buckley, Representative Wisnett, no. I use the 6.245 number for illustration purposes just to show what the impact is. We had quite honestly used, when the governor first put out his proposal, we used 6.06, which was his proposal, and showed what the effect would be. And instead of getting to 97%, we got to about just shy of 96%. But again, the illustration is to show the effect and how we move in the path. The exact number will adjust at the close of session.
So I appreciate that. And again, I'll try not to get in the ways and means. I mean, that's going to be very critical. You got to know where you're starting. If you're talking about 80% or 110% and all those, the baseline is very important.
Yes, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative. Representative Cobb.
Just a couple of quick questions, Mr. Zager. Here in your formula calculations of revenue, unless it's under a different title, are there federal funds included in this diagram?
I'm talking about this chart.
Yes, I'm sorry, page 1.
We have included, in our comparisons, we have included state and local dollars because the federal dollars are so volatile, we never quite know what we're going to have in future biennia. So we're trying to deal with those dollars that, in fact, we can forecast, because we can forecast local revenue dollars, and we can, based on the formula, forecast what state dollars are.
Okay. Just quick follow-up then. It was my understanding here in your notations at the bottom 4, it says these are based on the QEM estimate for 2003-2005. And I thought that QEM for 2003 and 2005 did include federal funding.
Representative Comp Chair Buckley, again, I would have to probably turn around and look at for my friend Brian because, again, what we're trying to do in these comparators is give you an indication on those numbers that are revenues from local and state right. that apply towards the cost of the quality right. of the model. And I'm sorry, I can't give you that.
Well, and I understand number. What you're saying, but I want to just make sure that we're comparing apples to apples.
Would you like Mr. Reeder to come up? I'd be happy to.
Sure.
Mr. Reeder, would you be so kind as to?
Yeah, that'd be because.
Thank you.
It's well over $1 billion or so, and it does make a difference.
Those billions, they do. They
it right. is billions. It's not hundreds. It's billions.
Thank you, Mr. Reeder.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, Brian Reeder, Department of Education. Representative Comp is correct. The QEM does include federal dollars, but for purposes of this table, we have included only state and local dollars simply to demonstrate the impact of the governor's proposal.
Thank you.
As Jim indicated, we have virtually no ability to predict what federal funding is going to be.
But just to clarify one step further, when the QEM model presentation first was developed, they did attempt to use those dollars for their projections within the model.
That is correct.
Thank
the
you.
The QEM attempts to include all funding.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Representative Wisdom's not going to be able to resist going after numbers, I can tell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then that means if what is. Representative Comp said is correct and what Mr. Reeder said is correct, then your baseline on the QEM is going to have to be adjusted, too. If you're taking the federal money out.
Chair Buckley, I'm not sure I'm following your question, Representative Woodman.
The QEM is giving us a dollar figure that we're supposed to shoot for in our budget, but that's including the federal dollars. We're going to have to either change how we report the QEMs, that it's only general fund and lottery dollars for that gold. Does that mean that if your answer, Representative Comp, is correct, that the QEM model goal does include federal money, but we're changing that not only general and lottery, it has to be adjusted.
Chair Buckley, Representative Wisner, the QEM forecasts separately federal dollars, local dollars, and state dollars. And you're correct. If we express this legislation in terms of all QEM dollars, then clearly we need to take into account federal dollars in the legislation. If, on the other hand, the intent is to look only at local and state mm-hmm. dollars, then we can express those portions of the QEM. That's but you're correct. Says. We need apples and apples.
How does it say that?
And that's what this does.
That's what this
where
does.
Does it say now?
Well, just clarification. My question would be with what I believe where Representative Wisnett's getting is for 0305, when you have the historical data and it has where the line says K-12 formula revenue per student dollars.
Go ahead, that's a good point.
The 6.6 there, if you subtracted, would you subtract the federal dollars from that amount and then would get the base of the local lottery and general funds?
Chair Buckley, Representative Comp, the formula dollars do not include federal dollars, so they're not in
there
in the
go.
First place.
Thank you.
So they're not there.
That's what I wanted to know. Thanks.
I hear you. I trust you.
Very good. As long as we don't trust Representative Roblin, we can proceed.
I have Representative Clem first. Representative Clem?
I think it's confidential.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course, I would like to note for the record how happy I am to see the Real Education Enterprise defined correctly with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission in there. But I do have a question about Oregon pre-kindergarten programs. This has been something I've been wondering about for a while. Because, I know that in one, sense we're talking about Head Start, but there are others, I take it, or else we would just probably say Head Start. And what I wondered about was something like Healthy Start or Relief Nurseries, where there's an education component to it. It's, taking place at, like, age 0 to 3, I think, for Healthy Start. A visiting caseworker might come and work on reading with the parent. And I didn't know if that's what we're thinking of or not in the Oregon pre-kindergarten programs term.
Chair Buckley, Representative Clem, it's a good question. The governor's focus has been on the what we call the Oregon Pre-K / Head Start, because in Oregon we have a collaborative between those, and students don't know whether they're in the Oregon Pre-K or the Head Start program. We're a national model for this kind of collaboration. So that's why, and those dollars run through the grant and aid process through the Department of Education. So that's where we capture those things, as well as those other elements that have dollars that run through the Department of Education are captured inside of these funds. If there are additional resources going to these programs, maybe through the DHS budget, et cetera, we haven't captured those.
Yeah, just quick follow-up. Yeah, well, these, I think, go through the Commission on Children and Families, which I don't know if they're a separate budget item or in DHS, but then they go down to Relief Nurseries and Head Start through that.
Correct. Chair Buckley, Representative Clem, you're right. And those funds are normally passed through the counties, yeah. And they deliver the services.
Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I read this bill, 2214, we are talking about the just the funding mechanism, 61%, 110%, whatever it might be. Where is the my concern is the performance measure and outcome. Is that a totally different subject, or is any way that the outcome performance incorporate in this bill at all? I don't see any in this bill.
Chair Buckley, Representative Lim, no, we didn't include that because, in fact, that is part of the discussion that goes on when we actually talk about the specific budgets and the performance measures. The I guess the best indicator that I can give you, and let me double back to a question that Representative Crummell asked Representative Cannon earlier about, you know, how do we know that the money is being spent the way we want it? We can look back to the 2001 legislative session where for the first time we had the school improvement fund, and while the money got pulled out from underneath the school districts during the recession, the state set out a target and said, you know, we want 80% of our third and fifth graders to hit Oregon standards in reading and math. Use your money to do that. And if you're successful, you can use the money to do something else that's necessary. Schools stepped up and they did it, and they continued to meet that target even though the money was pulled out from under them. So I don't think that there's any lack of commitment on the part of whether it's K-12, community college, or the universities to really focus on needs of students. And as long as we have as targets, and again, this kind of ties to the whole discussion that the governor has had about designing this as an enterprise, if we have as our state's goal not just individual performance measures on projects, but really what are the goals of the state? How is the system moving students towards these goals? Then we can talk about having targets like 40% of our students having some post-secondary credential. We can talk about what those goals are, and then you make sure that the system is doing the right thing in their individual community for their individual students to move success in that direction. The performance measures then should be marked along the way as we go.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Representative
Dahl. I want to go along that same line. When we freeze in, and I'm going to look at targeting, and there was a group that looked at targeting budget resources, and let's assume that we find that our kids are coming to school not ready to read, and we want to target pre-K. This allocation formula would preclude that, wouldn't it?
Chair Buckley, Representative Dahlem, no, it would not, because remember, this is a floor. And so what the governor has in mind is that if we find in our research of what's needed, that in fact additional resources are needed in a particular area, nothing here prevents us from allocating those additional resources. What the governor wants to prevent is to have a kind of piecemeal splattering of investment, so therefore you don't get the value of investing in the system, and having kind of disjointed investments. So one year we invest in something, then we pull the money out and we say, no, now we're interested in something else. So again, it is working with the system to make sure that there is a cohesiveness in the way we move forward. Your example is why the governor wants to fully fund Head Start, for instance. And so that is in the plan. If there was a decision on the legislature to expand that preschool opportunity for other students, say on a graduated scale or something, that could be an additional investment that is not prevented by this legislation.
Thank you.
President Roblin.
Thank you very much, Chair. My only question, and it kind of goes back to that one, we did talk about there being a floor, but there also being a ceiling, that being 100% of the QEM. So my question is, if we get to 100% of the QEM, and then we decide there's some other things that we need to do, are we prevented from doing those other things?
Chair Buckley, Representative Roblin, that's a very good question. Being in statute, no, because we can we can actually easily change this. One of the issues, and I'm sure others behind me might talk about this, is the quality ed model looks at getting 90% of students to standards. No Child Left Behind requires us to get about 98%. I look forward to the day when we get to the 90 and we have to deal with that remaining 8%.
Thank you.
I will struggle with you on that. I enjoy that.
Representative Krimel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regards to going back to this chart, if I can get it right, this chart, I noticed that it says the trend scenario of general fund revenue growth and PERS rate. Is this assuming a growth in the PERS rate, or is it assuming a flattening of the PERS rate, or a reduction of the PERS rate?
Chair Buckley, Representative Krimel, actually, I probably should have changed the title on this. This is a form that we have been working on now for well over a year, and each time we got a new projection from the PERS board as to what the rate would be, we were adjusting the number, and we had wild swings in what the impact of those numbers would be. So what we have done is adjusted these to the current PERS rate, and we've applied what they have provided us as what they think futures would be.
Very good.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Singer, thank you so much. All your work, it's very helpful, very impressive, very encouraged to see this on paper. It's interesting to note on your chart, the top by preliminary April 2007, that we are still, even if we pass the budget as proposed for the next biennium, we will be at 99.3% of where we were in 2001-02. It's interesting information to have. And again, I thank you for all the time that you put in this to make it so clear.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Klum.
Could you just relay to my constituent, the governor, that this is exactly my philosophy as well, and I'm doing my best to represent his views here. Very happy with this bill. Thank you.
What job are you on?
Chair Buckley, Representative.
So noted. Votes.
Your care for your constituents is well noted,
thank
Representative.
Thank you.
Mr. Wilson, would you kind of call up a panel for us, if
yes? Folks? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, can we please have Lori Wimmer Whalen, Tricia Smith, and David Williams? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you teach in that second up?
Yeah. We work on this school all the time.
That's right. It comes out of Goose Bay.
I
think we get where we're going.
Mr. Chair, just a point of clarification is witnesses could just, when they speak, just clarify when their comments are to which bill or to both bills. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you and welcome.
Mr. Chair, for your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the Oregon Education Association, its 46,000 members, and my collated testimony is on its way to you right now.
I like how you rubbed that in.
Yeah, that's good.
To the head of the class.
But I do have to declare that I have I refer to the dash ones instead of the dash twos in it because I wasn't aware. I apologize. Please replace the one with twos as you read it. And I also apologize for addressing the subcommittee instead of the full committee.
Again,
a 7 a.m. mistake. I apologize.
One clarification.
Just one clarification. Members, the dash twos are almost identical to the dash one. There was just one small date technical fix, so there's no substantive change, really. It was just a correction.
On that note, on the summary that we got, yeah, it has the date wrong on it as well. It says 01 instead of 11 on the previous bill, so we might want to fix the previous bill before it goes to the floor.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. HJM.
I will address my remarks, Mr. Chair and committee members, primarily to House Bill 2214 and only by inference to the previous resolution. We are here in support today of 2214-2, which we believe is the governor's roadmap to achievement of full funding for all education sectors. Our association has worked during the interim with both the governor's office and the speaker's office on this proposal to improve what we thought was a great concept that we thought could be even better, because we wanted to make sure that both in terms of timing and adequacy, we ended up in the right place, and we also wanted to make sure that the ratchet up came with a nexus to the true costs of doing education. We didn't want it to be an arbitrary percentage. We wanted it linked to the work done by the Quality Education Commission, even on the floor side of that equation. So we were very glad to see all those minds who came together to create the amendments before you, because we think that they accomplished that task. In its 2006 report, the Quality Education Commission noted that achieving full funding of the quality education model isn't something that could result in a perfect education system overnight, looking at the K-12 side of this bill. They said even if you had $7.77 billion, which is the predicted state share for the 07-09 biennium, on the table to spend right now, it would take time to build the buildings and to reinstitute programs that have been cut or to institute new ones and to hire the staff and so on in order to produce the programs that would be ideal for K-12. And so with that in mind, this roadmap does have a 4-biennium ramp up, which we think makes some sense. It gives the legislature not a mandate but a vision of how to achieve your goals. And, you know, the old saying is it's tough to achieve your goals if you don't know what they are and how to get there, seems to us to be appropriate. I also would say that in 2000, when the voters overwhelmingly passed ballot measure one, we did constitutionalize an adequacy threshold, at least on the K-12 side, that said very clearly that the legislature was to fund adequately. We don't believe that revisiting that with yet another ballot measure is necessary. We do, however, think it's important to find a way to move toward that goal in a reasonable time frame and grant you all the flexibility that you would need, given all the exigencies that Mr. Sager referred to in his presentation of the bill, and also to include the other sectors for the P20 continuum. We see this then as a pathway, a way to fold in our coalition's suggestions around the School Improvement Fund, which you've heard us talk about before, and to pull everything together in kind of a seamless way and move towards that adequacy, that goal. We also acknowledge that the Education Stability Fund would be capitalized a little bit more quickly through this plan, and we think that's a good thing as well. One never knows when the next downturn will come, but we do know it's sure to come. We believe also that the governor's plan reverses course on the recent disinvestment in education. And for illustration purposes, I've included with my testimony two graphs. The first one, which is your page 3, is simply a page out of the most recent, which is December 2006, Quality Education Model Report, that shows you, I think in a really nice illustration, the ratcheting down of K-12 over the last 7 years. It's a $1.2 billion loss of revenues that is approximately $1,800 a student. You've probably heard us all talk about that before. By reversing course, on page 4, you have my little graph, which shows both the baseline and the quality education model recommended levels for full funding in terms of the state share, all the way up to the 13-15 biennium. So you can see that, again, it does reverse course and moves us toward the goal to the 97% mark. It's been said that if you don't constitutionalize this idea, it doesn't have teeth and you can't hold the legislature to it. We would gently like to push back on that notion, and here's why. As I said before, we have a constitutional mandate that was passed in 2000 in every county in the state by a 2-to-1 margin statewide. We also believe that, like the School Revenue Forecast Committee, which produces the 3-year outlook of what both revenue on the revenue and cost sides schools can reasonably predict to be coming their way, that's not a mandate either for any particular spending level, but it does give them a compass by which to manage their districts. Similarly, this would do that for you. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll hear from your colleagues first, then we'll open up for questions after.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association, here to express our strong support for House Bill 2214, the Dash 2 amendments. And I very deftly did not put the Dash 1s on my written comments, so you don't need to change that out. do want to applaud the governor and the legislature for taking up the mantle of thoughts that were germinated last session, primarily around the issue of school stability, that came from many areas, and we're glad to see that that has grown into not just stability but adequacy as well in the form of this bill, and feel very strongly about to steal the word roadmap. Maybe a tired cliche, but I think it's accurate in that what you do with this bill is you establish the state policy of the state of Oregon saying that full funding for our schools is our goal, and that this bill is our method of getting there over a ramped up 4 or 5 year biennium approach. It's not something, frankly, that we've looked at in the past. It takes the notion of school funding away from the isolated 2 year window with which we've always looked at school funding. In some respects, maybe takes it out of the realm of the political and drives it more towards this goal-oriented approach and a long-term vision for where we want the education continuum to be in the state of Oregon. And we can't really speak more highly of that effort. As the representative of those local budgeteers on the ground who are developing budgets for schools, they all, again, would applaud for the adequacy effort, but they also do want to highlight the stability notion. As several people have pointed out and the charts have shown you, we've been through a roller coaster the last several biennium, and it's frankly made it nearly impossible for districts to budget in any consistent manner and provide the kind of reliable program for kids. Frankly, I think it's a testament to their abilities and their dedication to schools that, by and large, test scores are going up, students are succeeding, and we do have a fine education system in this state despite some of those challenges. This bill addresses, for OSBA, we have 4 legislative priorities, and this bill addresses the top 2 of those. So if you pass the bill today, I can go home and call it a session and leave the other 2 up to some other folks.
The word halftime, Mr. Williams.
I do want to point out 2 other, lest you think the education community is here saying that this is enough. I do want to point out 2 points of not necessarily concern with the legislation, but reminders for us all as we have this conversation about school funding. First and foremost, which we're already working on in other areas of this building, is capital construction. This bill is strictly operational side. I think as Ms. Wilmer Whalen pointed out, if we had 100% of QEM right now, which I'm sure we would gladly accept a check, but if we had it, there would be difficulty on the ground because of the capital needs involved in districts. In fact, it's one of our biggest issues with a lot of the proposals to move immediately to full-day kindergarten, that there are some districts who simply cannot do that because of the infrastructure constraints placed on them. And I just want to keep that in the forefront. There are some other areas where we're working on, and we think it's fabulous. The other point I want to address here is federal requirements. The quality education model, and this bill addresses that. We have state goals in statute, and to simplify them maybe a little bit too much, but the goal is that 90% of students shall reach standard. The quality education model identifies or attempts to identify that amount of dollars that would fund a system so that every kid, that 90% of kids will reach those goals. No Child Left Behind has superseded that and placed a 100% hurdle out there for us. So even under a framework where we say that 100% of QEM is the state's goal for full funding, it does not in fact mean that schools as a system are meeting all the goals and constraints placed on them, or are at least not being provided with the financial resources to meet all those goals. We have a saying that the feds have 7% of the funding but want 100% of the accountability. And just to kind of place that as part of the conversation, that's the federal level of funding is that 7%, which we and my partners at this table, and I'm sure all of you would agree, that we want to encourage the federal government to sort of ramp up their efforts efforts to fully fund the requirements they place on schools as well. And again, appreciate the hearing of this bill and strongly support moving it forward and moving that conversation about a long-term goal for the state for education.
Thank you very much. Do you have one thing you wanted to add there?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I forgot to say as part of my testimony that we had planned to offer an amendment today, which we have chosen not to do in the interest of moving the bill forward, but would like to perhaps do on the Senate side. Our members feel very strongly that once the QEM is reached, at the 90% of the QEM is reached, that it would be appropriate at that point, given the way we believe the funding would be spent, that we would alter the formula so that the kindergarten weight would go to the full weight for all districts, so that, because we would hope it would reflect mm-hmm. what we would assume districts would do at once they had that much money in the system. And so we had offered, we had proposed offering that as a friendly amendment and had talked both to the governor's office and the Department of Education about doing that. And I just wanted to put that on the record that it would be our hope that we could do that on the Senate side. We won't take the time here to do that, but wanted to make sure we mentioned it.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. Good. Working at all levels of education. And I'm here to speak to both bills, Mr. Chair, beginning with HJR 54. I would like to take us back a bit to remind ourselves what this bill is addressing and what all of these bills are addressing and how we got here. In the good old days that weren't necessarily so good, the legislature struggled with what the right number was to fund schools. How much money do schools really need? At that point, that's how Ballot Measure 1 came about, which is what you see in Article 8, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution. Because you and your predecessors, had passed a whole lot of laws saying school districts shall provide X number of hours of science, math, all sorts of things. School districts shall, without necessarily the funding to support those standards that they put into the law, kind of like the feds. The point of Measure 1 was to say that the legislature shall, and the language of the Constitution is very clear, the legislature shall appropriate an amount sufficient to ensure that the state standards are met. It's a truth in advertising kind of constitutional amendment, in our opinion. If you're going to set the standards, you need to pay for them. We believe that the federal government, if it's going to set the standards, should pay for them so that we can actually achieve those standards. That's the point of Measure 1. And then following that, that was the point of the QEM. How do you know how much money it costs to meet those standards, to provide that type of education that you have required of districts to provide to children? How much does that cost? The point of the QEM is to provide you that definition of how much it costs. And when you look at it, you can see how much each of those components cost within it. So now you have a constitutional requirement to fund sufficient to secure those standards, and you have the QEM, which tells you how much that costs. What we didn't have then was how to get there. HJR 54, we believe, sidetracks us. It is a great intent of its sponsors, all of you here and those not here. We understand it is an effort to try to provide a clearer direction to the legislature to fund schools adequately. And we appreciate that effort so much, because that's exactly what we believe you should do, is fund schools adequately. However, we believe the language in the Constitution already requires that of you. And we hope that you won't muddy the water on that issue with the courts by moving another measure to the ballot, which changes Article 8, Section 8 of the Constitution. In the meantime, though, a statutory requirement, as you see in 2214-2, provides you a very clear roadmap in how to meet your constitutional obligation. It tells you how much you may spend, how much you should spend, how much you must spend to meet the goals established in the law. It's a terrific roadmap. And I have to say that we opposed the governor's idea and the other ideas that came forward in the last session because they were not tied to the QEM. They weren't tied to those standards that you have created for school districts. And so we believed that any roadmap that isn't tied to those requirements was a false promise to students. 2214 is not a false promise. It says very clearly that you may not fund below 80% of the QEM, and it gives you a roadmap that shows all of us and our kids when we're going to get there. We support House Bill 2214-2 in its current form. We would urge you to move it from this committee. And we noticed, by the way, one other point. We noticed that this bill has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. I don't understand why it has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. It doesn't obligate the state to a large fiscal that I can see. And unless there's something I'm not seeing, I would hope you will move this bill and request that that subsequent referral be rescinded so that it can go to the floor of the House. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. We are in discussions with the Speaker's office on that issue.
Representative Dahlem.
Yes, I have a math question.
Yeah.
Let's assume social studies, 25 years. No comprende. Stay with us here, Ernie. If let's assume that the general fund does not receive any new revenue. This bill would then, would we meet the 61%? And are you satisfied with the 61% if there are no new sources added to the general fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, I'll do my best. I was, of course, a politics major across the street, so the math may be a little lacking there as well. It is my understanding that in our current revenue situation for this current biennium, that in fact the 6.245 exceeds the 61, or the 6.245 included with all of the other groups, bill exceeds that.
We have to get back to a math question. Parallel to parallel. If the general fund, because I'm going to take you down a trail here that could put us in a jam. If the general fund only receives the revenue that it has projected for now and no new revenue, are you interested in 61% of that amount? We can't go back to the 64 because that's a different, that's tied to a separate thing. Are you interested in 61% of the general fund? As it is projected right now without additional revenue.
It's my understanding that that's what Mr. Sager's chart is projecting, is the 61% going forward. And I think that, yes, we're very excited about the progress that 61% makes in the future biennium.
But if we're not funded at the 64 level, are you then satisfied with the 61%?
I guess
if we're not funded at the level that Mr. Sager has pulled. Here's where I'm going, and let me cut to the chase.
Representative Rolick could help explain Representative Dahlem.
Let me cut to the chase, and you can do the whole explanation.
Okay.
We have a trigger that says that it will be 61% or 80% of the TQM. In bad times, we would then need more than 61% of the general fund so that when times got bad, we would be giving even a larger chunk to education unless the Education Stabilization Fund could cover it. But if the Stabilization Fund does not cover it, and our bad times, I'm looking at worst case scenario, we would get into a position where we were funding education with more and more and more of the budget and other parts of the state's requirements with less and less. Could that happen?
Whichever member.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, I think that you're describing exactly a scenario for why we see a couple of strong points in this. One, why we think it's strong that it's statutory. A change. It does provide the kind of flexibility for hopefully the unforeseen or undesirable multi-biennium recessions that could face the state down the road. The other strong point being that this measure continuously appropriates other funds to the Education Stability Fund to keep it healthy, combined with the reserve funds that we have already passed in this session, I think, provide us with a substantial reserve amount. So my hope, and maybe it is a bit naive, but my hope is that we would be able to bridge those gaps in those future biennia where we are looking at a reduction in revenues. But under this scenario, I think having the sort of combined, you might say, the requirements in triplicate, the 61% of general fund revenues, the 10% growth factor, and the 80% floor of the QEM, I think provides the assurances to districts as they go forward biennium to biennium, and the assurance to students and, in fact, citizens of the state that education will continue to be a priority, and even when we go through those times of recession, there'll be a chance to sort of reset the clock, even if it is at that 80% floor, to reset the clock and sort of start that process back over. If you, let's say you had a three biennial recessions that really devastated the state, you would still reset the clock and begin that growth back out of that of that recession. And I think that that is a real strong point of the legislation.
Thank you.
Is there a real one you need to?
I will. That's the question. Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, one of the reasons, as most people here know, I've been involved with Chalkboard, and I personally really like the per-student funding ideas. However, that being said, this works for all of those things. And because it is statutory, it does allow, to Representative Lem's question, ways and means to have the discussions about how that money is going to be spent. It just tells you how much. To set those objectives that they want to set, to do all those kinds of things, is still within the purview of this legislative body. And because it's a statutory one, all those things clearly are available for this body to direct that money if they have to, if they believe it's not being done. I mean, QM kind of does it. It tells you what it's based on, and that means that's what schools should be working towards. If they choose not to, I think that we can set those standards and expectations in ways and means, as we have done, so that we do get performance measures that we clearly agree to about how this money is spent. And this avenue allows that to happen. And wouldn't you agree?
Mr. Chair and Representative Robel, and I would agree. And furthermore, I would point out that accountability is something that parents and students and school districts and legislators all have. And this might be considered in part of the legislative accountability, sort of. I mean, not softly, because as we've pointed out, there are fail-safes in the event of a funding emergency that enable you not to meet those targets in the path that's laid out. Certainly, you have to have that legislative flexibility. That's why we'd rather not see it constitutionalized. But it also is true that in the Ways and Means process, as we're negotiating right now with that body, it is our objective to be responsible for those accountabilities for student achievement outcomes and so on and so forth. There are key performance benchmarks, and those are also embedded, by the way, in the School Improvement Fund. And so we believe that there is accountability for all of us in this education system, and that this is just a piece of that.
Great. I'm trying to get to two other panels. If you have a quick question, I'd be glad to.
No, I'd rather hear more information than I pretty much know everything I'm going to say.
Very good. Thank you so much for your time and your testimony. Mr. Olson.
You can please have Dana Hepper and Otto Schell.
That was a remarkable admission, Representative Dolman. I'm glad it's on the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. Thanks so much for taking my testimony today. For the record, my name is Dana Hepper. I'm the statewide advocacy coordinator with Stand for Children. And as I always mention in front of this friendly committee, a former teacher. And joined Stand for Children as a volunteer when I was a teacher and became incredibly frustrated with my kids' lack of access to art, music, PE, school counselors, and librarians, and left teaching and became an employee with Stand for Children when I learned we were actually further cutting our librarians, counselors, and increasing our class sizes. And so I just really want to thank Governor Kulongoski, James Sager, Representative Cannon and the legislators on this panel for taking the time to dig into the issue of school funding in a serious, long-term, visionary kind of way. It's really exciting that we're having this hearing, and I'm disappointing that the destruction of our property tax base through, you know, Measure 5, Measure 50, and some of the other things that have impacted the budget you all have to write every 2 years have left schools coming to the state and having the state be the primary funder of our schools. But here we are, and we appreciate this visionary conversation for how to address that. Stanford Children has not taken an official position on HJR 54 or House Bill 2214, so just want to talk generally to the pros and cons that we see in the bills. The first pro we see to both bills is that they both plans strive to bring us closer to the quality education model, which is actually based on student need, not just on an arbitrary percentage of the state budget, but actually based on what we know it's going to take to educate our kids well in the state. And so that's and they also set really clear measurables for pre-K and for higher ed, which we really like. It's not our goals in these bills are not smushy. They're very clear. And I see those things as a positive. The second pro is that both bills give us time to reach that goal, and I think that's a positive for all the reasons you just heard. We have to give our state a time to catch up for what we've lost. An additional pro in HJR 54 is that it considers the capital construction needs that it will take to get us to the point where we want to be, and we see that as a real pro. This session, we have a lot of exciting opportunities, and we spent some time yesterday, Monday, talking about the things that we can do around capital construction for K-12 schools this session, and so we're thrilled to see that included in HJR 54. But a big concern we have with HJR 54 is that we believe we already have a constitutional reference to full funding of the quality education model set out by voters, and HJR 54 could actually weaken that constitutional reference by lowering the bar away from the quality education model for the next 14 years, which is just about as long as it takes a kid to get from pre-kindergarten to graduation. So that seems like a pretty long time. An additional pro with House Bill 2214 is that it sets a very clear path for achieving this goal. So as David mentioned, our school districts can start to plan for the future and know that they can add programs back because they don't have to worry about cutting them the next year, which is something we've heard from superintendents and school boards across the state over the last few biennium. And I think a kind of a fundamental, it's not a concern with these bills, but just something we're struggling with in general, is what Representative Dallum hit pretty squarely on the head, is that if we don't look really aggressively and visionary, and in a visionary way, just like we're looking at education at our entire state budget, we're really missing the ball. And so just really excited to take on that piece of the conversation. How can we make sure that we have the revenue in this state to make sure that we're doing exactly this, setting a vision for our public education system, but also being able to set a similar vision for public safety and health and human services. So that's all I have. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. I'm Otto Schell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon PTA. Many of the points that I would have made have been talked about, and I'll kind of skip around a little bit to try to add the parent community perspective on that. The first thing that comes to mind is we agree with Representative Cannon about aiming for excellence. I think that's a goal that most of us embrace. A lot of us tussle about what excellence looks like and how we measure or support that. His bill, the HJR 54, the bill shared by some of you, brings a few concerns from us. The first thing is that the constitutional aspect, we agree that K-12 is covered in the Constitution. Representative Roebelin alluded to the fact that the courts are in the process of determining what that looks like, what that means. In response to his question about what would the plaintiffs think, I haven't talked to some of the plaintiffs who I know, but I know about their families, and I know about similarly situated kids and families with kids of that age. I can tell you that we're not interested in slowing anything down. We're actually interested in getting adequate funding and a quality education process underway, fully implemented, and moving forward. I have a seventh grader. If we were to go with the HDR 54 proposal, I don't think my seventh grader would see any changes. He might actually see a step backward, and that concerns me personally. We're more interested in the court figuring out what the current situation is with our constitutional language and implementing the QEM. The other thing is that we're concerned about the removal of the reporting requirement, the Measure 1 put into the constitutional, and just in addition to the language about adequate funding. We believe that it would be the wrong message to send to the voters who so substantially passed Measure 1 that we've changed our mind about telling them why the legislature's not doing its job, why we as Oregon as a state can't seem to achieve a quality education for their kids. The other shared concern that I seem to share with a lot of other folks is, where's the plan for the whole child? Focusing on test scores alone or percentages doesn't give the full story on student success. And I just completed a weekend-long Oregon PTA convention. We met with people from all over the state. Some of them came to visit some of you. The thing that I heard over and over was, how can we have high academic standards? How do we get PE, foreign language, music, and art, all things anticipated by the quality education model, when we're continuing to kind of stand on the air hose of school funding? Just, we need to be really careful about that. And then the other thing that came up over and over in my discussions, both with our PTA members and leaders, but also with the broader community, that it's a mistake to presume that this affects only families of school-age kids. The costs associated with inadequate K-12 funding increase with each passing year, and every third grader who's unable to read, every dropout, every student who requires college-level remediation, because some of our higher ed friends will tell you about it, we're sending kids from high school to community colleges and to higher ed who need a lot of remediation. We're not getting the job done in the early grades. Each one of those kids is a detriment to the economic future and livability of our state. We are here to support the governor's proposal, House Bill 2214, as being a more comprehensive plan that gets us on the roadmap that we're all talking about. Mr. Sager's right. When I saw that it limits to 100% of QEM funding, that's a problem for us, because we know that the federal requirements of No Child Left Behind raise the standard much higher, and we have a lot of concerns from the people in the schools every day about setting our public schools up for failure, at least failure in a political or PR sense. They are doing better. They did amazing things during the downturn, but now it's time to put the money back into those schools. And education will pay for itself. It will pay for itself and more. It can be the engine that drives a lot of other good things for Oregon. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. And members who wouldn't mind, I'd like to bring up our next panel, so we'll make sure they have time to speak as well. Thank you both very much. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brett Rollett, Richard Levine, and Neil Bryant.
All right, very good. Mr. Bryant, I just had to say that tie is so yesterday.
Mr. Chair, Neil Bryant, and you're correct. This is the Beaver tie. I wasn't here yesterday, but I promised Dr. Ray and Jock Mills that I'd wear it today. So I'm a day late, and I'm more than a dollar short. You'll hear from my testimony. If I could go first, because we begin our Ways and Means presentations in a few minutes.
Oh, my gosh. Well, please do.
So thank you. I'm Neil Bryant from Central Oregon. I'm an attorney. I served in the Oregon State Legislature as a senator with Representative Lim for 8 years, and I'm a consultant to the State Board of Higher Education Chancellor's Office. The Chancellor was here, but he had to go to prepare for this other meeting. But I'm here on behalf of the board to say we support House Bill 2214. The board is a very good board, and they've done a strategic plan this last interim, and they knew that the state of Oregon could not reinvest in higher education in the way that it needed in one or two bienniums. So they adopted a 10-year program, and it's a five-biennium approach. The governor's budget is the first step towards that. And it's the co-chair's budget, by the way, won't get you there. And I'm sure you all realize that, too. And so James Sager's projections of where this would be, that also goes out over that 10-year period, and that's very important. It's important to note that we got an increase of 7.7% last biennium, but that was still below the 99-2001 biennium budget for higher ed. And if you want to put it into current dollars, in 1990, the state appropriation per student was $4,292. Then if you adjust for inflation, the state's adjusted appropriation is $2,443. So approximately $2,000 less when adjusted for inflation now. So that big turnaround you've seen since 1990 in how we used to finance higher ed is just significant. And, of course, the families and the students have paid for the largest portion of that increase with tuition increases and new debt. But also many students don't go anymore because they just don't think they can afford it. And so I know the legislature is addressing that with the shared responsibility model. But unless you increase access in the sense of providing for more rooms, more faculty, a quality education, there might be more funding available for students of middle income, but the access won't be there. And it's important to note that the 61% does not include capital. In the old days, the state provided all the money for capital construction. In recent years, it's been on a match, generally, for new construction. You raise 50%, and the state comes over 50%. And, of course, on deferred maintenance, you can't get match for that. That has been funded by the state, but only on the basis of kind of hold harmless. There's $600 million of deferred maintenance in our buildings, and 50% of the buildings owned by the state are on higher ed campuses. So what's been allowed is just enough to maintain it at around $600 million. The governor's budget is the first time that there's an attempt to take a chunk of that, approximately $50 million, and begin to remove that deficit, because that also then increases capacity, because as you upgrade classrooms, you put in the new lab equipment, you bring in something that can allow students to tie into a computer, and it's just a better place to educate and to learn. So with that, I'll stop and thank you for considering this bill and run off to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Bryant. As Vice Chair Comp would say, Godspeed.
Mr. Chair, real fast, Senator Bryant, you didn't comment on House Joint Resolution 54. Would the higher education be interested in that resolution?
I don't know. That was not unintentional. I listened to the testimony, understand the concern, and this is just Neil Bryant talking. The higher ed board and chancellor hasn't looked at that. But you always have to be careful about what you do with the Constitution.
Thank you, Mr. Bryant.
Mr. Levine.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, my name is Richard Levine. I represent the Oregon Community College Association, 17 community colleges, and over 350,000 community college students. We're very much in support of both bills. We support House Bill 2214 because, with the Dash 2 amendments, because we believe it sets a floor for community college funding for the future. One of the things that's not been talked about at all, and it's probably more pertinent to the university system and community colleges, is the tuition issues. Once you start to have a floor and can project out your budget over a number of years, it begins to become a little bit easier to talk about tuition on a long-term basis versus what we've had to do over the last 6 years, in which tuition has fluctuated. And unfortunately, that fluctuation has been upward and upward and upward. So by passing a bill such as this, or even a constitutional amendment in HJR 54, you begin to allow the system to smooth out the tuition issues that I know you're concerned with and I know the people in Oregon are concerned with. And that's a very important factor when you consider this particular bill for post-secondary education. The issue for us is to provide some long-term security for how community colleges are funding. I think all of you are aware, have heard from us or your constituents about the current funding situation, both at the governor's budget level as well as the co-chair's level. And in fact, the chart that Mr. Sager handed out is the actual governor's level, and we are seeking a higher budget than that. But The bills themselves finally allow some long-term look at how colleges will be funded. And for us, that's extremely important, not only for the tuition issue, but the issues around some of the programs that we've seen come and go. Just as an example, when there's a downturn in our funding, some of the first programs that go are the professional technical programs that provide a source of employees for economic development as well as business. And if you have more of a long-term look at where your budget is going to be, it becomes a little bit easier to decide that those programs should stay, and maybe to look either elsewhere or to figure out what a smoothing line would be to keep those programs intact rather than trying to move them in and out. So for us, we would prefer 2214. But at this point, either one of those bills would provide us
would
with
look
some
good.
Security. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lafitte. Mr. Roulette.
Thank you, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brett Roulette, Legislative Director with OSA. I think I'm required to say we represent over 100,000 students at Oregon's universities, community colleges, and OHSU. And students are very supportive of both of these bills, House Bill 2214 and House Joint Resolution 54. We had students give a presentation to you during the first few weeks of session, and they basically asked, they said, we're at a crossroads right now, and the legislature has to do something. The state of our higher education system in Oregon is in a crisis state. We used to be a world leader when it came to providing higher ed for our citizens, and over the past 15 years we've dropped to 45th in the country when it comes to state support of students. We've seen the largest state disinvestment since 1991, and higher ed is no longer something that I think our state can be proud of when it comes to the services that we offer our citizens. I am a Duck, a graduate of the U of O. I felt like I got a good education. I know. I apologize. I did wear a tie yesterday for OSU.
That's good.
You were disguised as a beaver?
I was
platypus.
I was supportive of many of our students in OSA yesterday. But right now we're facing a very different time than 20 years ago. Right now, as we look forward, 87% of jobs that are created in Oregon this decade require an education past high school. We can no longer look at education in our state as being a K-12 system, because that is not what students need to go out into the world and get jobs. We need to look at our system as a K-20 system, and that's what the education enterprise does. And we're excited because, as you all know, in the past, as the legislatures had to make cuts to deal with the recession, students in higher education have had to deal with the burdens of those cuts disproportionately compared to almost any other service that the state offers. We've seen tuition go up at record amounts. We've seen access become limited. And in order to reverse those trends, our state has to make a solid commitment. And by looking at education as a whole K through 20 model, that will be an answer. You'll be able to give the students the tools that they need after high school to go out and get those high-paying jobs, to be able to pay the taxes back to the state that allow us to create and provide the services for the citizens that they need. And you'll also make it possible for all Oregonians to have that dream and achieve that dream of going on past high school and reaching an education. So with that, I'm going to cut the rest of this short because you've heard most of it, and I know you'd like a break, I'm sure, before 3 o'clock hearings. But we do ask for your support of either of these. We do appreciate the governor's work on the education enterprise and Representative Cannon's work on HGR 54. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you both. Well said. Thank you very much. We do have one additional witness who would like to come up and testify on this, on one of the bills, I believe.
Ron Buell.
Thanks. Jim, we have just a few minutes left before we have to clear the room for the...
My name is Ron Buell. I'm speaking for myself today. I live at 2817 Northeast 19th Avenue in Portland. I've got written testimony coming your way, and so I'll just try to cover my highlights so I can get you out of here in time. I'm here today I support the governor's education enterprise legislation before this committee, 2214, but I'm here today to speak to you about the education floor referral measure. That's HJR 54. It's not really Ben Cannon's idea. Speaker Merkley has introduced similar legislation in the previous two sessions. In my 44 years of watching the Oregon legislature somewhat closely, I think it's safe to say that this is the single most important piece of legislation before the Oregon State Legislature this year. Why do I say that? Because as you rush around in this week trying to pass legislation out, this legislature is neglecting to solve in a long-term way the state's number one problem. It's a problem that's widely recognized by the state's press, and there's polling and anecdotal evidence from my own door-to-door canvassing that demonstrates that voters believe Oregon's number one problem is the state's underfunded and failing education system, and I'm talking about K-20 here, not K-12. My point is that you can't fix the problem by passing a good budget in one session for K-12. Congratulations. It looks like you will exceed 80% of the quality education model. That's $1.2 billion short, by my calculations, of 100% of QEM, $1.2 billion for K-12 short. You don't fix this problem by playing a zero-sum game with available monies during good times, during good economic times. Finally, addressing the K-12 budget, but shortchanging the Oregon State System of Higher Education and Oregon's 17 community college. Even if the education enterprise, as important and meaningful as I believe it is, passes, it has no mechanism that mandates a level of support beyond this session of the legislature. And no rainy day fund, as helpful as it might be, assures adequate or stable support of education from kindergarten through college, so-called K-20. You have needs in state police and social services and health care that you're not addressing in full this session. Maybe that's where future legislatures will spend your rainy day fund money in a down economy. Now, it's a time I would suggest that you provide some ability for Oregon's educators to plan for a future, that includes a stable and adequate source of funding for education. That's what's really missing. Any ability for local school boards or college administrators to plan for excellence with any degree of certainty. Since the legislature has faced the passage of ballot measure 5 in 1990, limiting property tax growth and requiring that state taxpayers provide half of the state's education money, we have seen some very good times for education. But we have also seen some very bad times for education in Oregon. What's next? Well, it depends on the economy and the seeming whims of the Oregon legislature. It's time that the Oregon legislature lift its sights to look to the future and to the rest of the world outside of Oregon. It's time that the Oregon legislature recognize that what is happening in Oregon's economy and in our competitive position with our neighboring states in the Pacific Rim. The point is, we face a changing world, a world in which knowledge and information, the foundation for inventiveness and innovation, are supreme. Oregon, meanwhile, fails to invest in its education system, its future, and its competitive position in the world. There's a clear trend in which Oregon's neighboring states and Pacific Rim countries spend more on education than we do. Their local residents have easier access to a quality education, and we are headed to a pure service economy in this state as a result. No knowledge economy for us, because no centers of excellence, innovation, and inventiveness in education. HGR 54 addresses this very important problems. It takes it heads on. HGR 4 may not be perfect today. Maybe it should phase in to 100%. Maybe it shouldn't. Maybe we should wait for a court decision that says we have to go to 100%. Maybe we shouldn't. Maybe we should put it up to the voters. That's what HGR 54 would do. I recognize that HJR 54 asked the people for an unfunded mandate, but it is a mandate that the governor will address with tax reform initiative for the 2008 ballot, I predict. And this referral gives Oregonians a chance to speak for their future. A chance to speak for their future, for an excellent education system that will pay back our economy 100-fold over the next decades. So let's have a work session. Give me a few days to produce some testimony from others in support of this unrecognized but important legislation. You know the support is there. If we take it to the teachers and the parents and the universities and the community colleges in this state and say, would you like to have stability and adequate funding for education? Would you like to have it for the long range? Would you like to refer this measure to the voters? They're going to say yes. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Buell, very much. Members, I'm going to hold over House Bill 2214 to the next possible time to schedule. Mr. Olson?
Mr. Chair, do you want it on the Friday agenda?
I'd like to be on the Friday agenda.
Okay.
Excellent. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 54. Close public hearing on House Bill 2214. Thank you very much. Mr. Olson,
just a clarification, you're going to hold it over for a work session or a public hearing?
For a work session on Friday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, members. I'm going to adjourn this committee hearing.